Welcome everyone to this week's Insignio Speaker Series. I'm very happy to be joined today on this first speaker series of 2024 with Ben Hayward. Ben, who is the CEO and one of the founding partners of 24 Asset Management. Ben, thank you for joining us this evening from London.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
Excellent. So Ben, maybe tell us a little bit about yourself. Give us a bit of background of you, of the firm, for those of you or for those of our listeners that are not familiar.
Sure. Okay. So I spent most of my career before I founded the firm at Citigroup in their alternative investment business, where I managed four vehicles that were investing in credit. So that was basically financials and global asset-backed securities. And we ran around $100 billion AUM through that team. I was there for 9 years and then left just before the global financial crisis. And co-founded 24 with the six other founding partners. And I joined that to run our ABS business, which we grew from, obviously from zero AUM when we founded the business, up to the largest third-party manager in Europe. And then in late 2021, I stepped away from that role and into the CEO role, which was remarkably amazing timing for what's been obviously a very challenging 2 years running a a fixed income business. But I think it's fair to say the environment's changed quite a lot recently. And so I think sunnier days ahead and more fun to be had.
Someone would say you have impeccable timing or you're a one lucky SOB, as they would say. But, you know, so we'll say that you have impeccable timing.
Okay.
So Ben, like you said, you grew up in the fixed income world. That's what you primarily specialized in before. We all know 2022 was a very peculiar year in the fixed income world. We hadn't seen a year like that in going back 90 something years. Tell us a little bit about what made that so particular. I mean, beyond the obvious that, you know, obviously we had the fastest, most accelerated Fed rate hiking cycle we'd seen in over a generation. Beyond the obvious, maybe tell us a little bit about where fixed income had come from, because it was very expensive going in, right? That's what also people don't or people tend to forget, which is, yes, it had a very bad year in 2022, but it was very expensive after what many would say would be almost a 40-year bull market in the space, right?
Yeah, absolutely correct. I mean, it had been a very, very long, if you look at it on that kind of macro scale, it had been a very long bull market, punctured relatively temporarily a number of times by relatively idiosyncratic risk events. And, you know, for those of us who've been around a while and want to think back to, you know, LTCM, Russia.com, you know, even pre then. Then typically what happened was in the last 20 years or so was that the Fed comes and other central banks comes riding to the rescue. And certainly since the GFC, that's largely been through injecting a massive amount of financing, of cheap, very cheap financing into the markets via the banking system. And what you get is a spike in vol and then a very, very quick recovery. And we saw that, you know, just thinking sort of backwards from today, we saw that obviously with COVID. We saw that with the European sovereign debt crisis. We saw it obviously with the global financial crisis as well. So not only have you had this going into 2007, sort of 30-year bull run in fixed income, you then have a period where that bull run is accelerated, but yields are massively suppressed by the amount of cheap financing that the central banks globally are chucking into the system. Right. So, you know, I think for the last 10 years, people have thought about markets being expensive or cheap within what historically would have been a very, very narrow range of movement. So by the time we got to sort of late 21, when inflation data started moving upwards, you know, people's range of expectations of what could actually happen had been materially compressed by what they'd experienced over the last 15 years and as you say, the last 40 years, you know, as well.
Right. So tell us a little bit about how you're seeing the space today. We've seen, you know, the 10-year went from a 50, the 10-year in the United States went from 50 basis points in the depths of the pandemic. It touched 450 at some point earlier or later last year. What do you think about the fixing the rates market now? Let's talk about rates and then maybe we can get into to spread product. In terms of rates, the market is expecting, roughly 150 basis points of rate cuts from the Fed over the next 12 months. The Fed last told you that they were only going to cut 75. Seems to me that a lot of the way that not just the rates market go, but other risk asset classes are going to go depends upon how much of that gap or what's the gap between what the Fed actually ends up doing versus what the market thinks the Fed's going to do. So maybe a few comments on that.
Yeah, sure. I mean, this is the ideal place to start because what all of your clients are thinking about or their sort of current frame of reference is obviously the last 2 years worth of challenging markets. And while there have been other smaller drivers of that risk off move, the main driver of that underperformance is the rates market. It is what the central banks have been doing. And I think the really easy comment to make here is that barrier to performance has gone, right? There is almost no one who thinks that rates are going up from here. And what that means for investors is that they are free to earn the yield they expect to earn, right? The volatility that has negatively dragged their total return down. And has removed the benefit of the yield. That's gone now. Okay, so I think when we look forward from here, everyone has a view on when rates are going to move and how far they're going to move, and those are the two things: when and how much. And anybody who tells you their high conviction on that, I just don't believe at the
Right.
moment. And you can see that really, really clearly in the uncertainty. Quantitatively, in the uncertainty that's out there in the data, and one really, really good place to look at is the dot plots that the Fed publish. Okay, so they for those of the listeners who aren't aware of this, each Fed member publishes their expectation of where Fed fund rates are going to be for the next 12 months and a little bit more. And at the moment, there's 150 basis point range in the dot plots.
Well.
Okay, so these are the guys who make the decision. And if they can't get more crystallized around a direction, around a quantum of that direction, than 150 basis points, then anybody else who tells you they know what's going to go on, I would question their credibility to be quite honest.
Absolutely.
So I think there's obviously a lot of focus in the media around. Is it going to be March, and what's the probability of it being March, and how many rate cuts are priced in for the rest of the year? And I think that when we are talking to investors such as yourselves at the moment and trying to talk through them to their clients, we would want to tell them that's not the right question to be asking, okay? Because that is then getting you caught up in the minutiae of a timing. Of a decision based on timing, and based on what is going to happen with the Fed fund rates. Now, most of your clients on a long-term basis aren't going to be invested in the Fed fund rate. They're going to be invested in the 10-year, that's the point that you picked. Maybe in the 5-year, but a lot of fund managers are going to be invested in the belly of the curve, and the long end of the curve, and that doesn't necessarily move with Fed fund rates. There will probably be a bit of a rally, but if you think that the Fed is going to cut six times, you're going to get 150 basis points reduction in cash rates. Does that mean the 10-year comes down 150 basis points as well, and you make a great capital gain? No, not at all. There's absolutely no guarantee. In fact, with estimates of where the neutral rate is, where the Fed will take interest rates. To a sort of zero growth level, or sorry, to a normalized growth level, that at the moment people expect that to be around 3%. And historically, when we don't have markets that are massively distorted by QE, the gap between Fed fund rates and the 10-year is around 150 basis points, which actually puts the 10-year at the moment at the same level. So I think the point I'm trying to make is there's a lot of uncertainty out there at the moment, but that uncertainty.
And that's also to throw in the fact that there's a lot of uncertainty as to where the neutral rate of interest actually is, right? I mean,
100%.
impossible almost to say beforehand, ex ante. Many models try to predict it. It's very difficult to predict. And there's certainly a lot of uncertainty as to where it is today, vis-a-vis where it was, 10, 15, 20 years ago, right?
Yeah. So I think, what do we know now is the interesting thing. What are we really high conviction around? Well, one, cash rates aren't going to go any higher than they are at the moment, right? No one is saying that. The Fed's not saying that. No market participants are saying that. The cash rate is going to go down, right? So those two points for investors at the moment, if they are invested in cash or in the very short end of the curve, that's literally saying all the good news for that positioning is out there already, and that is only going to get worse from here. Okay. So I think that is really, really key, because those are the only things that everybody is aligned with at the moment.
Does that worry you that everyone is aligned in that view, that almost no one is talking about let's say, a potential a resurgence or a renewal of the hiking cycle? Like, does that concern you at all?
I think whenever everybody we speak to globally is tilted the same way, then you have to question what the implications are for that. But I think what makes us makes us a bit more sanguine about it is that the way people are deploying their cash with that in mind does differ. And so you don't have the market very, very heavily tilted with everybody in a very, very tight trade. And you can see that because I'm assuming a lot of your clients are still very heavily invested in the short end of the curve, in cash and 6 month govies. But that's not where everybody is. We are seeing increasingly people starting to deploy into higher yielding opportunities at the moment.
Excellent, excellent. So, Ben, let's move a little bit beyond the rate market. Let's talk about spread. We can start off first with the investment grade universe. Potentially, let's start with the U.S. one. How do you see that market or that asset class unfolding this year?
So I think, I mean, I'll probably give you some quite general comments actually that will cover a lot of credit in one kind of go, because while there is a sort of differential in value between IG versus high yield and different sort of geographical sectors, I think the sort of top-down view is broadly similar. So one is that yields on an absolute basis are attractive, but in some sectors, credit spreads, so what you're getting over the risk-free rate, is starting to look a bit more expensive. IG certainly drops into that camp. And US high yield, I would say, also kind of drops into that camp as well. I think a lot of that is because when we look at the US economy and US corporate reporting, the results still look very strong. The data continues to support at the moment the idea of a soft landing, the kind of Goldilocks scenario. And because of that, and because investors are so convinced that the rates are going to get cut, people are buying yield where they can find it. And that has compressed the opportunity in some of that space.
Okay. Any other sort of house views from 24 that you'd like to share with us?
Well, I think there probably are a couple. I mean, certainly in terms of positioning, as a result of that, we would be favoring a couple of parts of global fixed income over the US at the moment, because there is more value there. And certainly we would include in that financials, principally European financials, because their core equity tier one ratio is way higher than the regulatory minimums, like, you know, way beyond what they need to hold at the moment. Their net interest margin, their non-performing loan statistics are very good. You know, we haven't seen the same issues in that market that we have done in the US regional banking market, and I still don't think that those issues are fully solved. And actually, I think that does then create a sort of a flashing red light for large swathes of the US commercial real estate market as well. So we like European banks on an absolute basis. We definitely like them on a comparable basis to US banks. And principally, we like them at the additional tier one level. The other part of the marketplace that we think is fundamentally very cheap as well is European CLOs. Obviously, there's a big US CLO market. The European CLO market is broadly similar. It's more diversified geographically. Obviously, it's investing across different countries rather than one you know, big economy. But they broadly work the same way. But the yields on offer there are fantastic. We're talking into mid teens available on rated debt. So those are the two parts of the market that we really like at the moment. I think they're not low beta parts of the marketplace, and so, you know, our house view on where the economy evolves to is a little bit more bearish than the market average. So this Goldilocks soft landing, we don't think will actually happen. We think we will get a pretty shallow recession, the kind of thing that we talk about on this kind of call, but that actually doesn't really materially impact Main Street. But in that environment, I think we want to be improving our credit quality. So then we look at sort of higher beta assets like AT1s and CLOs, and we say they're fundamentally cheap. So we want to keep holding those. But if we look at how we take beta out of our portfolio to prepare for that kind of evolution, then we've been materially cutting both European and US high yield, which again are kind of higher beta parts of the sector. So and we've been deploying that cash then into the US Treasury market to get a bit of a relatively chunky liquidity bucket built up, and something that has some naturally protective characteristics if we do see the market realizing it's overpriced the Goldilocks scenario.
Ben, we had a research call this morning where we were discussing earnings so far, the earnings picture so far, and we specifically got into the conversation of the banks and the U.S. banks and how everyone's focused on how well J.P. Morgan did, how well Goldman did, but if you look at everyone else, they didn't really do so well. Earnings are not coming in very strong in most banks. They just came in strong enough one or two banks. Are you any concerned that some of these? It sounds to me, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it sounds to me like you're perhaps a bit more concerned about U.S. banks than the market is, generally speaking.
Yes, we are, but not really about the big banks, to be quite honest. You know, this is a regional banking issue, and
So
you
you
know,
think that those concerns from last year will flare up again at some point?
I think there's a good chance that isn't being priced into the market properly if that's the case. And you know, our sort of core thesis is that creates vol, but it doesn't create a credit crunch of any sort. And I think, you know, savvy CEOs like Jamie Dimon, for example, typically see that as quite a good opportunity. You know, he's not allowed to increase his deposit ratio anymore. He can't, but unless he needs to go and bail out an institution that's a deposit holder. So I think this is definitely a regional bank issue. But the reason I link that to a commercial real estate issue as well is that the proportion of US CRE that's funded by the regional banks has massively increased over the last 5 years, which in and of itself wouldn't be a problem. But there is a big refinancing wall coming up in that part of the marketplace. And if all the lenders in that space, or the majority of the lenders in that space, are capital light and their cost of funding has gone through the roof, and the underlying asset, i.e., commercial property, has gone down in value because interest rates have gone up so much, you've kind of got that perfect storm for a banking problem to become a CRE problem as well.
Okay. And I'd like to remind everyone that if you do have questions for Ben, please submit them in the chat. I'd be more than happy to share them with him right before we finish here in just a few minutes. Ben, let me ask you before we move on to perhaps geopolitical concerns, the elections everyone's sort of talking about, let's talk about perhaps the most unloved part of the world right now. The Chinese equity market. I know that the fixed income space is your domain, but do you or 24 have any sort of house views on China, whether it be the economy, the bond market there, the equity market, any sort of asset class in the country?
So we don't invest in EM really at all, even on the bond side. So our colleagues at Vontobel, who own 24, they have a burgeoning EM equity business and EM debt business. So I think the safest thing for me to say is I don't have a view because I genuinely don't have a view. I think the one comment to make that has scared us pretty consistently over the last couple of years is the amount of interference that corporates are getting in China from the government, and it's obviously impacted education, in particular with online training, and it's impacted the real estate marketplace. And I think that just creates a pretty material risk for everyone, no matter where you are in the cap structure, whether you're equity or a senior lender. So no massive insights other than if I was there, then I would be sort of slightly concerned and probably looking at ex-China.
Let me ask you this then. Any other developed markets? We've talked a little bit, or we've talked a lot about the US. We've mentioned Europe a bit. Any other developed markets that you are seeing opportunities in or that you are invested in?
Yeah, I mean, it depends whether you include UK as part of Europe, and that's not a sort of political joke.
I was going to say that's a very charged political joke there, Ben.
Yeah, no, well, quite possibly.
Do you
The
consider the UK part of Europe? How about that? I'll turn that
I mean, geographically and from my holiday plans, yes, I do.
around.
But not from a political point of view. And it obviously is very closely tied still on an economic basis. They are our main trade partner. But I think within the UK, when we compare the UK even with Europe, even with our sort of closest peer, there is still a yield premium and a spread premium that has resulted from Brexit, and that is way overpriced. So that does create a massive, well, a massive, a very significant investment opportunity. Now, when we look at our portfolios, we are in particular Strategic Income, which I think we are relatively evenly allocated across the US, Europe, and the UK. So don't get the idea we're sort of plunging in there. But I think that on a relative value basis, there are some excellent opportunities in the UK, and that's just because investors have repatriated some of their cash and created a yield premium. But the easy kind of comparisons to make are banks. You can look at the amount of CET1 ratio, you can look at their book performance, and you can look at the yield you're getting between those markets, and it is still mispriced and very attractive.
Okay. Great, Ben. So let me go to a few questions that I do see here. One question that I am seeing is what's your view on the Bank of Japan, and which way is are they headed? Like, are they going to be raising rates when everyone else is cutting?
If there is the right environment for them to be forced to do that, I think that generally central bankers, they don't coordinate their behavior, but I think it's a lot easier if they are moving in the same kind of directions. It creates less volatility for a single geography, but they will need to be in an environment where they are under pressure to be doing that. Now, to a certain extent, that pressure is evident in the fact that they are so divorced from where the other rate environments are. Is it a problem for them to be hiking while the others are cutting, if they're going to end in the same kind of spot? I think we need to see how the economic fundamentals for all the central banks evolve over the next 12 months to actually get more of a flavor for what they're going to do and when they're going to do it. Notably, they are continuing to be quite guarded, and once markets move too quickly in a single direction on an expectation of something that they can't guarantee, then try and walk back the market a little bit with comments.
Right. Question here. What is the strategic income portfolio yielding at the time or at the moment?
The gross yield on the portfolio is around 8.5% at the moment. I think, to be specific, I think it's 8.46 today in US dollars.
In USD. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And
So
then, go ahead. Sorry.
That does reflect relatively conservative positioning at the moment. While we are bullish on credit and don't see a credit crunch coming along, we do think that the market is right in the direction of rate travel. So all the good things are there in place at the moment. There are there, as I said before, there's a bit of a risk that some parts of the market are overpriced, and we might see a bit of a backup on our short-term basis. But also, if our core scenario does play out, that there is a technical recession, then what we might well see as a result is that the Fed cuts rates, maybe not a long way, but does cut rates, and we get a bit of a rally in treasuries. And at the same time, we might get a bit of an overreaction in credit spreads. And then what we really want is the beta being dampened by our UST holdings. And then we access the liquidity by selling those USTs, and we go and buy the too cheap credit that's out there in the marketplace.
Right.
That's a very simplified explanation of what we would do. But I think the comment is that 8.5% could be more. But I think just explaining what we expect returns to look like this year, we would expect with that big barrier to absolute return performance over the last 2 years, i.e. rate hikes, with that being taken off the table, that investors, whatever kind of strategy they're investing in fixed income, should be expecting to earn the yield on the portfolio when they buy it, and there are good opportunities for capital gains on top of that. So you can read into my 8.5% where you think our total return is going to be for the year.
Excellent, excellent, great. And then Ben, final question here, because we're unfortunately running out of time. What is the most powerful message you can give clients regarding the importance of moving out of cash and short-term government markets?
This is probably a couple of points here, right? So one is the client's frame of reference for investing at the moment has become massively compressed, because they're thinking about 2 years' worth of pain, and they're investing short term, and they're thinking forward maybe 3 months or 6 months. But these are people typically who normally have a 20-year history of investing, and their financial goals are 5, 10, 15 years, right? And investing on a short-term basis massively skews your total return, because it comes down to timing. And I'm telling you, as someone who's in the markets every day, I don't know what's going to happen day to day, week to week, right? So trying to time markets is incredibly bad. The question they should be asking themselves is, what are my financial goals? Do the yields on offer at the moment help me achieve those on a 3 year or 5 year basis? And if so, what am I waiting for? Because what we know is that there is obviously a massive amount of cash on the sidelines. From what we are talking about, clients from Asia to the US, on this topic, they're saying the cash levels, or short-term government bonds, around 40%. When that money starts moving into the bond market, we are going to get a sharp, quick rally and a powerful rally. And we saw the first sign of that in November, December last year, and things moved a long way quite quickly. We've all seen a bit of a backup this year. So if you've got a client who's sitting on 40%, they want to hit a sort of a 30% return target over the next 3 years. They can do that in fixed income. But if they don't commit to it now, when they can lock in that yield and they think they're going to time it, that's a terrible short-term decision.
Yep, fully agree with you. Market timing does not work. It's been proven time and time again. So there's a plethora of academic literature out there on the subject. So I invite you all who have the opposite view to take a look at it. I'm sure your minds will be changed rather quickly. Ben, thank you so much for joining us. I know that it is late in London, so it's probably it's 9:33. Is that right?
It is 9:33. Yeah. I'm going to go and help my son with his economics homework. funny enough, it's on inflation.
That should be fun. Sorry for you. You spent 30 minutes talking to us about it. Now you have to go.
Not at all. It's great to talk to you guys.
Excellent. Thank you so much. Have a good evening. And thank you, everyone, for joining us.
Thank you.
Insignia Financial Group, LLC, comprises a number of operating businesses engaged in the offering of brokerage and advisory products and services in various jurisdictions, principally in Latin America. Brokerage products and services are offered through Insignia International Financial Services, LLC, headquartered in Puerto Rico, and through Insignia Securities, LLC, headquartered in Miami. Both are members of the Financial Industry Regulatory Authority, FINRA, and Securities Investors Protection Corporation, SIPC. Investment advisory products and services are offered through Insignia Advisory Services, LLC, an investment advisor registered with the Securities and Exchange Commission. In Uruguay, advisory services are offered through Insignia International Asesores de Inversión Uruguay, SA, Insignia Asesores de Inversión Latam, SRL, and Insignia Asesores de Inversión de Uruguay, SRL, in Argentina, and through Insignia Argentina, SAU, and in Chile through Insignia Asesorías Financieras, SPA. Collectively, these 8 operating businesses make up the Insignia Financial Group. To learn more about the broker-dealers, including their conflicts of interest and compensation practices, please go to https://insignia.com/disclosures/ or via www.finra.org. To learn about Insignia Advisory Services and any conflicts related to its advisory services, please see its Form ADV and brochure, which can be found at Investment Public Advisor Public Disclosures website, https://advisorinfo.sec.gov/.